beach easy.
When we take people surfing, a lot of times we pick them up, you know, in our arms and carry them into the water. And it's touching for me to think about that, because there might be a point in my life where someone has to pick me up and carry me, you know. If you've ever taken care of a relative that needs help, you know, that used to be, for lack of a better word, able-bodied and now isn't, you realize the fragility of humanity and how that we're all in this, like, sinking ship called life, and the only thing that really matters is how we treat each other.
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. From personal growth and self-discovery to challenges and victories, we discuss it all. Join us as we dive into the extraordinary stories of ordinary people all the way to the end.
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. I'm Julie, and today I'm with Luke Sharp. Though he's not originally from the Myrtle Beach area, he's now an active member of our community. His story starts in a very unique place, the circus.
You kind of had an interesting childhood, Luke.
Yeah.
When I spoke to you before about it, you were like, "Not, it really wasn't, but it really was. I'm just telling you." So you were born in Tennessee.
Yeah, Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Yeah. And your mom came from a really interesting background. And in as much as maybe we're affected by our ancestry, there's that. But on the other side of this, it's just a really interesting story. You have circus family in your blood.
Right.
Tell me about your aunt and your mom's beginnings with the circus.
Yeah, I'll try to be concise. It's a long, crazy story, but I'll and you know, you talked about one of the things this podcast is people overcoming things.
Yeah.
And I think we have a generational overcoming of things in my family, and it started when my grandmother and her sister left Tennessee. They were invited to be exotic dancers in the La Paloma Club in Miami. And they were given, basically my great-grandmother was given bus fare for them and some of their friends. And they went down to Miami and worked as my aunt used to say, they were strippers, you know, at a club down there called the La Paloma Club. And they were underage, you know, in today's or any time, you know?
Yeah.
And the club was destroyed by the Ku Klux Klan because they had what they called cross-dressers back then. And it was a club that was open to the gay and LGBT community, you know?
What year-ish? What decade is this?
Late 30s, you know?
Yeah.
And then they rebuilt, and eventually they got shut down by the city for their lewd, you know, activities. Yeah. And my aunt went to prison. She married the club owner, and she ended up going to prison for 2 years. And when she got out, she went on to become a world famous circus performer. She was a performer from the time she was a child until, you know, until she passed away in the early 90s.
Do you know what got her into it? Was lion taming?
Yeah,
right?
She started out when she got out of jail, she started out as a barker for the circus and traveled with the circus, and then she got into lion taming, and she had a whole bunch of lions and tigers. And When I was a child, she had this half tiger, half lion called a Tiglon, which is much more rare than ligers is the other one. She used to tell me there's only four in the world. I don't know if that was true or not, but at the time, and my mom was a trapeze artist in the circus, and she got pregnant with me at 16. So she was a single mom and had to get out of the circus and leave part of the time she was in Catholic school, and she got, you know, kicked out of Catholic school.
Yeah.
You know, because she got pregnant with me, and then she got pregnant with my brother Charlie. But
yeah. So was she just on the road with a circus? Do you know who your father is?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
He just someone who traveled with the circus?
No, I met my father later in life, you know.
Yeah.
And everything. But yeah, my mom, and he's a good dude. He lives in Georgia. I know him.
Now, when did you meet your dad?
I was 22, I was in college.
Why did it take so long for you to meet him?
Again, I don't want to embarrass my mom, but she didn't actually tell me that he was my dad. I just, like, one day I got curious and just looked up, because we don't have the same last name or anything. So I was in college and I just had some memories. So I think I called like the courthouse or something like that to find out when stuff happened.
Yeah.
And things didn't add up. So I'm like, I told her, I'm like, hey, Mom, what's going on here? And she goes, okay, your dad, your dad lives in Georgia. This is his name and everything. So I just called him and he was surprised.
Did he know you existed?
He did. Yeah.
He did.
Yeah.
But he was surprised to hear from you.
Super surprised. When they had split, his mom and my mom got together because they were both teenagers and made a deal that he would just stay away. If he stayed away, you wouldn't have to pay no one would have to pay any child support or nothing like that.
He'd just keep it clean.
Yeah. Like, and I think that, yeah. and I feel bad for him because I feel like that, you know, for 22 years, he wasn't able to contact his son. I was in college when I met him and stuff. And they were super nice. We met and you know, now he calls me and texts. He texted me yesterday and when I was hosting an open mic and he tried to call me and I'm like, text him. And I'm like, hey, I'm in an open mic, you know, and I'll text you later kind of thing. He's super nice.
Well, when did you meet him? So you called him.
Yeah, I called him.
When you were in college?
Yeah, when I was in college.
And then did you make a trip to go see him? Or did
He drove up. I went to college in West Virginia at a place called Alderson Broaddus College.
Yeah.
Which ironically, my aunt was at Alderson Prison for Women. Which used to be Alderson College before it became a federal penitentiary for women. And when it merged, it formed Alderson Broaddus College. And that's the college I went to. So my aunt thought that was really funny.
Like, well, that is pretty funny.
Going to college where I was in prison, you know, kind of thing.
That's really funny.
Yeah, but anyway, he drove up to see me. And
Were you like nervous or were you just kind of like, whatever?
No, I was like, whatever. You know,
it'll be whatever.
Yeah, it wasn't big emotional. It wasn't like a big, I mean, it was nice to see him and stuff, but I didn't feel like cheated or anything like that. You know,
yeah.
Mom did a great job.
Luke's mom had been a trapeze artist, but that wasn't the life she was leading when she gave birth to Luke.
So did she quit the circus life then when
yeah,
she had you?
She had pretty much quit before and started, because she was in the circus, she was like schooled on the road. You know what I mean? She wasn't like in a school. And when she got to her early teenage years, she went back with my grandmother and stayed. They have a boarding house and she stayed in Tennessee and enrolled in Catholic school. And then that's where she got pregnant with me. Then later on, she had my brother, Charlie, and stuff. And later on, we ended up moving to Miami. We lived in Miami.
What did your mom do then for a living?
She was a nurse.
You?
Yeah. My grandmother watched us and she would go to nursing school. And she became a nurse, and she would work nights and sleep during the day while we were going to school, you know. But yeah, when in Miami, we, like I said, went to Catholic school also, just like she did,
mm-hmm.
and like her, I also got kicked out because my grades were bad.
Well,
but I had to go to public school, which was great because I learned to speak Spanish, you know, a little bit and stuff, and
yeah. Well, how much younger is your brother, Charlie?
11 months and 2 weeks younger.
So you're super, super close.
Super close. My brother Charlie's closest. We're super close, yeah. My mom was a great mom. She's a single mom, raised my brother and I with just love all the time and just sacrifice.
Yeah.
Amazing human. You know,
and she's still alive, right?
Absolutely, yeah, very much. She lives in Chattanooga, Tennessee. She was just at my youngest daughter's college graduation on Friday. She graduated from USC, and my mom was there. And
how old is your mom now?
She's I'm 54, so she's 16 years older than that. She's 70, yeah, 70, okay. 71, yeah.
Oh, she's still pretty young.
She's young, yeah.
How would you describe your mom?
She's just full of energy, very extroverted, and talk to anyone and makes friends with everyone, loves everyone. I told you about my great-grandmother having a boarding house, and then my grandmother took over the boarding house, and my great-grandmother died. And then when my grandmother died, my mom took over the boarding house, but she ended up just basically, she didn't make a lot of money in the boarding house because she just took in homeless people off the street and just let them live there. She just has a huge heart. It's hard to meet anyone that just has more love than my mom. Literally, she filled her house in a small trailer park that was associated with the boarding house with homeless people. She would just pick them up off the street. And she any money she gets, she just gives away. When she's walking down the street, sees a homeless person, she'll just hand them her money, you know. She just has so much compassion for people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you think that's rubbed off on you?
Well, I mean, I like to think I have compassion. I mean, I believe in kindness and love and compassion very much, you know, and I think it's, I'm naive enough to believe that kindness can solve the the world's problems if we just are willing to listen to each other and accept people who are different than us, you know, and be able to hear views that are different than yours and stuff and make friends with all kind of different people, be part of a community. You know, I've learned that's super important. I'm not saying that I've done anything really great or I'm a really, you know, great person or nothing like that. You know, we all have a lot of growing to do as humans. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I try to follow her example in believing that kindness and love is what it's all about, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And we'll see that when we talk about kind of your life now and a lot of the projects and the things that you do.
Adaptive Surf Project, we'll get into that.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, so to be raised by a little powerhouse like that teaches you that, not just teaches you that or takes you to, you know, church once a week to hear it, but actually lives it.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty powerful role model you have there.
She's been great. Yeah. Great role model. And you know, she's back in Tennessee and, you know, has a lot of friends and she's very active in her church and all that stuff.
Luke learned a lot from his mother and that served him well when he became a teacher. Here Luke shares his family move to the States, the birth of his daughters, and adoption of his son.
I went and got a master's degree for teaching at West Virginia University, and they had a little, like in the library, they had a bunch of folders with job things, and it was just a piece of paper in there that said jobs in Guam, so in Micronesia. So I called, and the next thing I know, they said, well, meet me at this Holiday Inn in Missouri. So I drive to Missouri. We had just gotten married. I was married to Kai at the time. I drive to Missouri, and I open the door, and there's some people like with muumuus, and you know, like they look like you know Pacific Islanders, just in a and they interviewed me and got me a plane ticket, and flew out there and lived there for 3 years. It was great, and I did some volunteer work in like Chuuk and Yap and Pompeii and Palau and some of the other islands, and met some people that were in the Peace Corps, and they were making $200 a month, and they had a bicycle, and I was making $50,000 a year, and had a rental car, and you know, and we were doing the same job sometimes. I'm like, well, that's amazing.
That's pretty crazy.
It was crazy. It was really great, though.
What made you want to go there? Just a sense of adventure.
Just travel. I want to
see
travel
the world. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and it was a great experience. I really enjoyed it out there, you know, living in a tropical island and scuba diving and all that, you know.
Did you always know you wanted to be a teacher?
No. After I graduated with my four-year degree, I was just hiking one day and I really enjoy this and I'd love to have my summers off. And that was really the only reason I became a teacher, just to have the summers off.
Yeah.
But I realized once I started doing it, I really love it, you know.
Yeah.
It's a job where you get to make a difference in a lot of people's lives. You know, you get an opportunity to really make the world a better place as a teacher. I think it's important, you know, and I'm getting to the end of my teaching career. I got one more year and I retire. I started teaching in 1994. So this is my 30th year. That's crazy.
Yeah. Time flies.
Yeah.
What did you learn in Guam? What did you learn about yourself or teaching overseas?
One thing about it is, you know, I want to be careful and say this, but there's a lot of things that was going on in Micronesia that I was uncomfortable with, you know, when I got there. Like, some of the mores were different in some places, you know, and some of the, they had brought a bunch of American teachers over there. The Department of Defense actually paid the government of Guam to bring all these teachers because they didn't want to build a Department of Defense school. Mm-hmm. They were trying to improve the regular Gov Guam schools. And a lot of the teachers got over there and just tried to change everything. They tried to make it like, well, back in Missouri, we do it this way or whatever. And, you know, I got with that crowd and they were just beating their heads against the wall, you know. And this one Chamorro teacher, that's the local people are Chamorros, she said to me, you got to just look at this place like you're watching a movie, you know. Mm-hmm. And just do your best and don't try to change anything. You'll be a lot happier. And that was good advice. And that's what I did. I just, you know, like they want us, the principal said, you know, wear a tie to school every day. And all the, what they called, they use the word Hallie for white people there. I said, all the Hallie teachers are wearing ties and all the local teachers are wearing shorts and flip-flops and T-shirts or Hawaiian type shirts and stuff. And it just made a real division. And after that, I started wearing shorts and flip-flops.
Because why not?
I just got into it and had a much better time. You know? Teachers would bring, like, food to the classrooms, and kids would just kind of go everywhere. It was a different, you know, a different environment. And it was this thing where, like, all the teachers were kind of stealing from each other. You know, like if you needed a textbook, you would just go steal it from the other teacher. And it was almost like a game going on. Everybody kind of laughed about it.
That's funny.
But the American teachers were going nuts and they were quitting and leaving and stuff. And but once I kind of got in with everybody, it was and understand what was happening, it got to be super chill.
Yeah.
You know, everyone was playing music in their class and eating and,
that's,
you know.
That's kind of fun.
There was no tardies at school. It was just very nice.
Yeah. Well, when was your first child born? While you were over there?
No. I got pregnant with when we were there. And that was part of the deal. I'm like, let's just stay here forever. This is great. I was getting so happy there, you know. And we were having a fantastic marriage. I mean, you couldn't imagine two people more in love. It was really great. And she got pregnant and she's like, I'm moving to the States. I want my child to be born in, she's from Asia. She's from Burma. And she's like, I want my child to be born in America. You know, and my mom had this house. So we moved and we got here just in time for my oldest daughter, Sanibel, to be born at Laura's Hospital. And then later on, 5 years later, we had my daughter, Zeta. And then, later on, I adopted my son, CJ, and then came Brooke, who was already an adult, but we adopted her. She was raised by my neighbors, her grandparents, but she needed insurance. So we ended up with four children, and two of them was with Kai. And unfortunately, moving back to the States wasn't good for my marriage because we stayed married till like 2010 or 9 or something like that. And we ended up getting divorced. But
why?
I think we would still be married if we stayed in Guam. And also, I think part of it was, I look back, I mean, we got a divorce, but I think if I was more mature, I could have saved the marriage and didn't. And I feel guilty about that. I'm really fortunate. I met Erin, my wife, and she's amazing. We've been married for 10 years. Our anniversary is this weekend. So I've been married 26 years, not to the same woman,
right?
16 to Kai and 10 to Erin. Yeah. And Erin is amazing. She's put up with me and the kids, now that the kids are adults and stuff.
Everybody gets along good.
Everybody gets along great, you know? Yeah. And we were at my daughter's graduation. Kai was there and stuff. We've always lived really close. Even after the divorce, we were half a mile from each other in Loris. And then when I moved to the beach, she moved to the beach, and we were just a couple miles from each other.
You and your ex?
My ex, yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, and we both saw our kids every day some way. We, you know, they were raised. We always had a child, you know, in the house.
Did parenting teach you, or does parenting teach you anything about yourself?
Oh, it's the only thing that I've ever done in my life that's meant anything.
Right.
Is raising kids is, to me, that's all that has really, that's the only important thing I've done in my life. Everything else has just been for fun.
Yeah.
You know, just that's it.
As his kids grew up, Luke began exploring other interests. He started a band and the Adaptive Surf Project.
Hate when people say, oh, there's no waves in South Carolina or whatever. There's waves, man. We have waves. I can surf every day. I go down to the pier and I just look out at the vastness of the sea and I think about the fact that a swell has traveled thousands of miles to break on the shore at Cherry Grove, and I'm just honored to be able to ride those waves, you know?
Yeah.
Just like everything I do, I'm not a great surfer, but I've been doing it for many years and I love it, you know? It's beautiful. Yeah. And that's why I started Adaptive Surf Project.
Right.
Because we wanted to share the joy of surfing with people that happen to have disabilities.
Right.
My friend Brock Johnson started an event called Will to Surf. And he happens to use a wheelchair due to an injury and stuff. He's a surfer and a lifeguard before. And he wanted to start this event. So like 11 years ago, we all got together and we started this program called Adaptive Surf Project.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just expanded and grown and
I'd like to note that a previous podcast guest named Ernie Johnson was part of that program. Ernie suffered a spinal cord injury in a football game at Conway when he was in high school, and he's taken part in that program. And
the funny thing about my first job when I moved here was at Conway High School. I was working at Conway High School when this happened.
That's nuts.
Yeah.
Do you remember it?
Oh, yeah. There's no way not to remember it. It was a big deal. I think it happened at like practice or something even. And they put a picture of him on the wall. The city of Conway declared Ernie Johnson Day. Ernie is and he is just an amazing, positive person.
Mm-hmm.
And when he started our program, I was just trying to convince him to surf. And he's like, I'm not getting in the water. I don't, you know, it wasn't something that he was into.
Right.
And the first time he surfed, you know, he felt like he almost drowned.
Yeah. He told me it was not a good
experience. Was not something he wanted to do. But then, like a lot of people with surfing, the magic of riding a wave just clicked one day.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm addicted. I want to get better. And then he said, when do you surf? And I surf before work. I go at 6 o'clock in the morning. I go down to the beach and there's Ernie in his, not a beach wheelchair, his regular wheelchair, sitting at Cherry Grove Beach, watch right before the sunrise, first light, he's on the beach. It's like, let's go surfing. And he started meeting me in the mornings and started surfing with me. And eventually a gentleman named Tyler took over as his coach, and it's his lifestyle now. I mean, Ernie is in Costa Rica right now, surfing.
Is he really?
Yeah. He texted me yesterday, hey, I forgot to invite you, but I'm going to Costa Rica tomorrow. You want to go? Like, Ernie, I got to work. That's the last minute.
But that's amazing.
It's become such an important part of his life, and he's gotten really good at it. He's gone to California with us to compete in competitions. He doesn't compete anymore because he's a soul surfer.
Right.
He's an amazing, positive person.
He really is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's overcome tremendous amounts of obstacles in his life.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm blown away by people. And the thing with Adaptive Surf Project is I work with so many individuals that happen to have disabilities that you forget. Ernie one time was, we were going to a church they were doing a donation to Adaptive Surf Project. Mm-hmm. And Ernie went with me to the church and he parked in the handicap spot, you know, the handicap parking spots. And I looked at him, why are you parking there? Oh, wait, I forgot.
Right. Yeah.
You forget because it's just your friends. Yeah.
Yeah. But how often do you meet with that group? Like, how often are you active with it?
We're just a community now.
Yeah.
So it's all the time. I mean, like, even when I play music, you look around, there's five or six people that are going to be there in wheelchairs or with some other disability or something, people with autism or Down syndrome and things.
Yeah.
We're all just a family now. And you don't know how many people have disabilities until you start getting people in your lives. It's just a 5% of humans have mobility issues.
Mm-hmm.
1 out of 20. That's a lot, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then you add on that other apparent disabilities like, you know, Down syndrome or whatever. You get to the point where you're just family, you're just friends.
Yeah.
So like we meet at the pier on Sundays and just surf, you know, and people just show up, you know, informally.
Yeah.
That are adaptive surfers and need help surfing because I know we're there.
What have you learned doing this?
It's been life-changing because, you know, the main thing that I've learned is that community is the most important thing. We have created a community in Adaptive Surf Project, and we do adaptive biking. We're involved with Coastal Adaptive Sports with their adaptive basketball, with their wheelchair basketball. And every aspect of my life now includes something with Adaptive Surf Project. And that's why it was really odd to come and do a podcast about my life, because all I talk about anymore is Adaptive Surf Project. Tuesday, I was at the women's club in North Royal Beach. 110 women were there, and I did a speech about Adaptive Surf Project.
Yeah.
And my message is always the same, is that when it's all said and done, all that's going to matter is kindness. Kindness and love is all that matters. And if you live like that, you're going to want to help people. And Adaptive Surf Project is not just to help people with disabilities, but it's to help the people that are helping people with disabilities.
Right.
We have a human need to help others and to be thought of as good people, right? This gives you an opportunity. You know, people need help regardless. I might need help moving something or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
When we take people surfing, a lot of times we pick them up, you know, in our arms and carry them into the water. And it's touching for me to think about that, because there might be a point in my life where someone has to pick me up and carry me. You know, if you've ever taken care of a relative that needs help, you know, that used to be, for lack of a better word, able-bodied and now isn't, you realize the fragility of humanity and how that we're all on this like sinking ship called life. And the only thing that really matters is how we treat each other. You know, that's what I got out of this. And Adaptive Surf Project, it's taken over every part of my life. In many ways, my wife Erin is the treasurer, and my friends are all involved in it. I have a friend named Van that he was delivering beach wheelchairs yesterday to people that are on vacation, you know, while he's working, and it's his life too. You know, it's all my friends. We all just, when I play music, it's part of Adaptive Surf. We write songs about Adaptive Surf Project. Doc, our lead singer, wrote a song called "Ride," And it's about a day he went to the beach and this woman came from down from Chicago who'd never seen the ocean. And we took her surfing and she was in a wheelchair and her family was so happy, you know, and it just, the joy it brings people just to see making other people happy. Like if you're about the perfect gift for someone and you're like, yes.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like.
The Adaptive Surf Project has touched many lives and families, and it has taught Luke some incredible lessons as well.
I've had so many people come to me that are like, when they're at our musical gatherings, like, oh, you people, your music has saved my life. I feel so much, I was in a low place, now I'm in a high place. At Adaptive Surf Project, volunteers are coming to me. I needed this community. People have confided in me terrible tragedies and stuff that's happened to them. And they've said that this community has saved me. You know, I feel a purpose and stuff. And I think that's important. And obviously I hear it from the participants and their families and the people that happen to have disabilities and my fellow musicians that play music. It's all together. It's all part of the community. And I think that's what it's all about is community. You know, if you build a community and you uplift everyone and really try to curate it. And when you see a crack happening in the community, go to it and try to fix it. You two aren't getting along. Let's find out why. Let's have an adaptive peace project right now. You know, let's get together.
Yeah.
You know, because the reasons we don't get along are stupid.
Right.
You know, and I tell you, now that I'm 54, I look back like on my divorce and things like that and just realize how immature we were. And everyone has those thoughts, right? Mm. And you just try to make things better now, right? And you look back, oh, I was so stupid back then. I wish I had knew then what I know now.
Well, yeah, but that's what we're here for.
Exactly.
Is to learn and grow, right?
Yeah, make the world a better place.
Community, connection, and kindness. That's what Luke has in his life and what he's given to countless people. He learned those lessons early from a mother who exemplified them. Luke's legacy is one of acceptance, kindness, and service to everyone.
If you've been inspired by this story or any others, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review.